court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. I am just a dude.
I don't know if you got a chance to watch it the other night, but did you happen to catch the O.J. Simpson interview?
I did.
That was crazy.
It was. If I would have done it, but then he'd say, I remember this.
Yeah, I was just sitting with my mouth open thinking, wow, this is really happening.
I mean, he basically just said he did it. Of course, everybody knew he did it.
Well, I went through my mind as to why somebody might say, hypothetically, if I did this, why I would do it. There is not a single reason I could come up with that a rational human being would do that unless they actually did it.
Yeah, well, and he really had nothing to lose because he'd already been acquitted criminally, so they couldn't retry him. And he'd already lost the case civilly, so he's paying for that. So what other recourse does anyone have?
I know. The whole time after that episode aired, I was thinking, what was that jury thinking during that criminal case?
You know, there's a lot of things that could have been. A lot of people considered it jury nullification.
Well, we should talk about that today.
We should, but first, I have an update from a previous episode.
The dog's out hunting.
The dog's out hunting, as it was suggested. Well, we learned this week that not only is United Airlines, the friendly skies, willing to take an elderly gentleman and beat him and drag him off an airplane, if you don't like that, they'll kill your damn dog.
Yeah.
They'll take your dog and put him in the overhead bin and kill him. Now, to tell you the truth, I'm surprised. I didn't know that an animal would suffocate in an overhead bin or whatever happened to it. I'm not sure unless other things got crammed in on it, like overhead bins tend to get over-crammed. So I'm not sure the specifics of what caused the death, but everything that I've seen says the training is you don't put them in the overhead bins. You put them on the floor in front of the passenger at the feet.
Yeah, I've never really seen an overhead bin that locks that airtight. Now, I was on an international flight one time to New Zealand, and it seemed like the way the overhead bins worked in that in the middle row seemed to be pretty airtight. So mm-hmm. I don't know if it was one of those styles because it was almost like a bucket that came down. And then when it went back up, it was like whoop.
Well, I hadn't seen that, but he was in there 3 hours.
Oh, well, that was an international flight then.
No, it was a 3 hour flight though. But whatever happened, I don't know. But anyway, they made him put it up there. And then when they got to the other end, that's why the dog wasn't making any noise.
Man, I can't imagine that.
I know. That's pretty bad. I mean, you know, I think they must hire their stewardesses from like North Korea or something like that. You know, they're all like Kim Jong-un people there. They just don't care. They'll beat you up, they'll drag you off the plane, and they'll kill your dog.
United Airlines, faces of death.
Now, on to jury nullification.
Well, jury nullification has been a topic that has been suggested throughout the ages of court appointed.
and we've referred to it from time to time with several different subjects, but we've never gone into it in depth.
That's right. Now, it's been suggested by Mark Super, Maxwell Edison, Jim Hansen, Julia Kuhn, Kelly Justice, Eric Vallejos.
Wow.
All those dating from back to 2016.
So with that accumulation of votes, we had to cave in and do it.
That's right. Had to nullify our desire not to do it and go ahead and do it.
Well, it's one of those little known things, and it's because the legal profession wants to keep it that way. It's their dirty little secret.
Well, it's not a dirty little secret. It's just something. I mean, and I'll give you my opinion about it later on towards the end of the episode.
But all right.
I don't want to.
Don't give away the ending.
Yeah, exactly.
Make them read the whole novel.
So if you're not familiar with what jury nullification is, it's what occurs whenever a jury returns a verdict of not guilty in a criminal case, despite its belief that the defendant is guilty of the violation charged. The jury, in effect, nullifies a law that it believes is either immoral or wrongly applied to the defendant whose fate they are charged with deciding. So basically, in a criminal trial, the prosecution is supposed to prove A, B, and C. And during the trial, they prove A, B, and C. But for whatever reason, the jury says, nah, we don't think so. Not guilty. And they kind of thumb their nose at it. Now, it could be for a lot of different reasons, and we're going to go through that. But it's basically where the jury is not following the law as laid out.
Right. They have other thoughts.
Yeah. Now, trial by jury is one of the hallmarks of our legal justice system. On some of the quotes I've seen about trial by jury is it's the very palladium of free government and a valuable check upon corruption. So it's pretty much one of the most important things in our society.
Well, I would think so, that our whole due process is built around that.
Yeah, and especially when you're taking away somebody's civil rights and things like that. I mean, it's a pretty big deal. We have such faith in the jury trial and what a jury decides that ultimately, whatever the jury ends up deciding for their verdict is law, is basically what happens. And for the most part, anything that happens in the jury room is sacrosanct. Like, it's beyond reproach. Can't change it, can't undo it, or anything like that. Absent some sort of, like, jury tampering or something like that.
Right.
But for the most part, it doesn't matter. Whatever a jury decides is what a jury decides.
They can't be held responsible for it.
That's right. Now, the thing about it is if a jury acquits somebody, then the person can actually not be retried again. And that's because of the Fifth Amendment Double Jeopardy Clause. So
it's, I saw that movie.
As I say, it's a little known fact that the Fifth Amendment was actually based on an Ashley Judd movie.
Yeah. Double Jeopardy. I saw that movie. I learned all about it.
Now,
John Adams was outstanding in it.
Double Jeopardy does not actually attach until the jury is impaneled. So if you go through pre-trial things and the jury's never impaneled and never sworn in, and then the case is dismissed and then rebrought, then they can do that. Double Jeopardy doesn't attach until the jury's been impaneled. So that's a little...
They have to actually issue a ruling.
No, they don't have to issue a ruling. They just have to be impaneled.
Oh, so if they were impaneled and then for some reason the case didn't continue?
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's when it actually attaches, is when Double Jeopardy attaches. So a little trivia for you there for your bar trivia.
Bar trivia, you answer that one.
Or take a bar exam.
Do you actually have to be acquitted to be qualify for Double Jeopardy, or can the jury merely be impaneled?
That's true. But yeah, but so basically once you are acquitted of a crime or a charge, they can't come back and charge you with it again. So they might have the most slam dunk case and prove everything they need to do. The jury says, nah, we're not buying it, and acquit the guy. Doesn't matter. Can't come back and charge him again. What is done is done.
I can't acquit you, baby. I'm stuck on you.
Just making that up, or
yeah. Oh, I'm sure there's a song there. I can't quit you, baby, but couldn't bring it up right there. The memory banks weren't serving me well.
Now, there's certain periods where jury nullification has been used quite a bit, and I say it seems to be used quite a bit because we're not exactly sure when it has been used and when it hasn't been used, because basically what happens in a jury room for the most part is private. We don't really know. So,
well, not only that, it's not like they have to have all gotten together and said, hey, let's do jury nullification on them.
Yeah.
It can just be a discussion in there where they say, well, yes, this and yes, this. But you know what? It's just not right.
Yeah.
The way this went down. And I think for this reason, everybody in there agrees with you.
Yeah.
You know, or the several of them or whatever.
And they don't actually come out and say that to the judge when they read their verdict, saying, well, we all thought that he was probably guilty, but we don't think the law was right. So we're not. I mean, they don't do that. They basically just come
right.
out and
say guilty or not guilty.
Yeah, not guilty.
We found the defendant not guilty.
Yeah.
I saw that on SUV last night.
Law and Order SUV?
Yeah.
It's a Forerunner. The origins of jury nullification are said to be in England, and some of the first instances allegedly are whenever Quakers were actually prosecuted for not belonging to the Church of England, and people were reluctant to convict them based on their religious beliefs like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you think about it, that does seem like something that would be kind of ripe for a jury nullification type argument.
Sure.
We're just not comfortable putting somebody in jail because of their religious beliefs.
Exactly.
I mean, it might be against the law, but you know what? That law is stupid.
Well, and it depends on, I think sometimes it depends on, too, if they actually believe that's what it really is. I mean, there are people that hide behind that, you know, like sovereign citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my religion says that I don't have to comply with this. I don't recognize you as a government over me. Well, that's okay, you know, to a certain point, but depending on what you're doing, it won't work.
The flag flying in this courtroom has fringes. Fringes designate a court of admiralty. Therefore, this admiralty court does not have jurisdiction over me as we are not at sea. That's my best Dale Gribble.
Well, you know, one of the things that people worry about in jury nullification is, can you get in trouble for it? And the short answer is no. And the principle of it is, like you talked about with the Quakers and everything, it comes from Bushell's case, a 1670 English ruling where Edward Bushell was a junior in a case against William Penn and William Meade, and the two were charged with holding a tumultuous assembly. And what that meant was they were holding it in the street because they'd been locked out of their own building, their meeting hall. So they held it on the street. They ruled it a tumultuous meeting. So they charged them with that. And the jury, which included Bushell, they refused to convict Penn and Meade. And this infuriated the panel of judges, who locked up the jury without food or water until they arrived at a correct verdict. Mm. The jury refused to change their verdict, resulting in Penn and Meade's acquittal. The justices were still not satisfied, and they fined the jurors and sent them to prison until the fine was paid. Bushell was one of the jurors who refused to pay the fine and remained in prison as a result. He appealed his case, where a higher court overruled his punishment. The judge's ruling established the enduring principle that jurors cannot be punished for their verdicts.
Yeah, and that's
that was in 1670.
Yeah, that's a good rule.
Yeah.
Now, you use the word tumultuous.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I hear the word tumultuous, I always think of a Jimmy Buffett song.
Tumultuous?
Yeah, I think it's from God's Own Drunk.
Oh.
When he's talking about being on by the still, and he dreamt himself some tumultuous dreams.
I always thought it was tremulous dreams.
Oh, you might be right.
You never know for sure. My buddy Bear.
Buddy Bear.
I counted every hair on his 27-acre body.
That's right. That's probably my favorite Jimmy Buffett song of all time.
I was God's Own Drunk and a fearless man.
Speaking of Jimmy Buffett, Justin and Lynn are interviewing him on the red carpet, right?
Yeah, they did that this week.
It's pretty exciting stuff. Yeah. I saw a picture of Taylor with Jimmy Buffett.
Taylor was up there with him. Yeah, that's right.
Now, to get back to the topic of jury nullification, though.
Yes.
So, it started in 1670, and that's where we had the basis for it. And then, basically, in the United States, some of the principles or some of the errors when we've seen it, there's been different errors, and it's usually related to something that is kind of going on in the country for the most part. And that's when, well, at least that's when you have a lot of it. Where you might be able to say there's some sort of jury nullification type movements, as opposed to just your average, well, it's a jury nullification case here, jury nullification case there.
But you don't really hear about it. I mean, even if it is one, you don't really hear that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like OJ case. You know, a lot of people wonder, well, why, how did he get acquitted? Well, when you study about jury nullification, I think that might have had something to do with it, although it's never come out and said that.
It might have, but again, you never know. I mean, it could have also been, I mean, they're sitting in the jury box for a while, and they heard the story and didn't think he did it for whatever reason. I mean, who knows?
Well, he was a very popular fella at the time, too.
He was.
And he was well-liked. And I can remember when I first read the article in the paper, the first day when OJ's ex-wife was killed and they were questioning OJ. I said, and I remember my reaction was, can you believe that? Somebody's killed his wife and they've got him in question, and poor OJ.
Yeah. Poor OJ.
Yeah, well, that was the first day of it, though. But yeah. That was everybody. He was a beloved athletic hero, you know?
Oh, yeah. During that show, they showed some of those commercials and some clips from The Naked Gun, things mm-hmm. like that. I mean, he had the world in the palm of his gloves.
Yeah, the glove that wouldn't fit.
That's right.
So you had to acquit.
So I think part of that was great defense work by the defense team, shifting the blame from the case and putting it on Mark Furman and the racist things going on there. And they also played on the whole race thing going on in that time period as well, I think, quite
right.
a bit.
Well, that was after the Rodney King verdict and
yeah.
everything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that had
that
some
had
influence.
That had caused riots.
Now, one of the other things, one of the other eras, whenever there was some jury nullification going on, had a lot to do with race as well. And we're going to get to that, but before that, I think we have a pending motion.
Why, yes, we do there, Michael Esquire. If it might please the court, I'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right, who do we have on the docket?
We have a new sponsor to this podcast, and we are excited to have their first ad for the first time on this show anywhere ever.
Doo-doo-doo!
It is Abbey Connect.
So, Abbey Connect is the leading live receptionist service which helps law firms and other small businesses screen, qualify, and convert incoming calls.
Did you know that 80% of potential clients don't leave a message when they reach a voicemail? Clients want to connect with real people, not machines or recordings.
I know whenever I call a business or I'm looking to get in touch or find somebody, oftentimes if I call a business during regular business hours and the answering machine picks up, I hang up and go to the next one.
Sure, if you're in a hurry, like if you've got a leak in your house and you need a plumber, you're not going to leave a bunch of numbers on voicemails and hope somebody calls you back.
No, absolutely not. You need something right now.
And the fact I need some help, and I need it now.
The fact is, in today's world of now, if a caller can't reach someone, they're going to call the next company on the list. Voicemail kills business. Calls mean clients. You invest in a website and digital advertising, shouldn't you invest in converting those calls into customers?
Now, most of you listening to this podcast can't afford to hire a receptionist or an assistant, but our sponsor today is Abbey Connect, which offers dedicated and guaranteed call answering at a fraction of the cost, and we're talking about live people. You get your own manager that manages your group of people that answer your calls, and they understand your business and what you can do, and they answer the phone and get the clients for you.
Tommy and I, as small business owners, can attest that customer care is a necessary and rewarding investment, and Abbey Connect is the perfect mixture of high-end call reception and cost efficiency. Increasing revenue and building trust through meaningful connections is your Abbey Receptionist team's goal.
Now, for our listeners, Abbey Connect is offering a no-obligation, free, yes, that's right, I said free trial. Sign up today, and you'll make missed opportunities a thing of the past.
And after your trial is over, our listeners will also receive $95 off their first bill, but only when you sign up at our special link, which is abbeyconnect.com/court. That's
abbeyconnect.com/court.
ABBYCONNECT, in case you're wondering how to spell Abbey Connect.
And we thank them for sponsoring our podcast today.
Thank you, Abbey Connect.
Thank you very much.
Now, some of the other racial eras where jury nullification came into play, during the Civil War, juries, in particular the ones in the North, would tend not to convict a person who had allegedly violated the Fugitive Slave Act. So basically, if someone in the North had helped a slave escape or harbored them, even though it might not actually be a crime, juries were very reluctant to convict anybody of that in the North.
Yeah, they had laws to that nature that said that you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people that didn't agree with that.
No, quite a few. And there were instances in Syracuse and Boston where large groups of people were charged with these various acts of assisting slaves. And there were repeated prosecutions where juries just basically refused to convict these people. And eventually the government in these different areas just declined to pursue any kind of further prosecution for these.
It was fruitless.
That's right. It was fruit of the fruitless tree.
That's right. Of the poisonous tree. You're just costing the taxpayers money. Don't bring up any more of these cases, bub.
Now, one of the other areas where jury nullification was prevalent was when the 18th Amendment was in force. Do you know what the 18th Amendment was?
It was one right after the 17th.
You're right. It was the one that outlawed booze. Oh, Prohibition.
There you go. And so they didn't want people prosecuting their people that were getting them booze.
That's right. And there are estimates that 60% of the time people were charged with alcohol offenses during Prohibition, they were found not guilty. So think about that.
Yeah.
Well, more than half.
Jury, your peers, if you're supplying the drinks, they're the ones drinking.
Yeah. It's like, oh, we caught this guy with a beer. We want you to put him in jail. And somebody there looking at each other like, are you serious? Don't you have something better to do?
Yeah. So in a way, you know, we've talked before about how laws don't keep up with the times. They kind of lag behind because there's so much red tape involved in changing it that it usually lags behind. Capital punishment was a big one. It kept saying by the time they would change the law and enact the death penalty, then public opinion had turned against it. So then they would do away with the death penalty, and by that time, public opinion had changed and said, we want it.
Yeah.
So they're always behind the curve. This was a way of the people keeping the government up with the curve.
Yeah, it's kind of like got its pulse on the finger of what's going on.
Finger in somewhere.
In something. Now, this prohibition jury nullification was in part what a lot of people believe led to the passing of the 21st Amendment. And do you know what that was?
That must have made it okay to drink.
Well, yeah, but it was
repealed prohibition.
It was the amendment that came after the 20th Amendment.
That's true. following my former line of logic.
But yes, the 21st Amendment repealed prohibition. Now, I was thinking about this as far as...
I hope they don't do a 22nd one. I don't want to stop drinking.
No, the 22nd Amendment is actually the amendment that limits the number of times somebody can be president.
Oh, okay. So if they're too drunk, they can't be president too many times.
Yeah, pretty much. So if certain presidents are elected multiple times, then you're going to need to be drinking. So.
That's true. Not to name any name.
It got me to thinking, though, about this this whole prohibition thing is, like, it's very similar possibly to current marijuana laws.
Yeah, exactly.
Because juries these days tend not to convict somebody just on a simple marijuana charge. They're not going to do that. And actually, I've seen it in practice where the prosecutors are kind of reluctant to bring any kind of marijuana charges if that's all it is. Usually, it has to be a pretty large amount or something else like guns and things found along with it. You don't see somebody prosecuted just for marijuana these days. And most of the times, it's written down to almost like a speeding ticket or a traffic ticket to these days, too. So,
well, one of the states that kind of led the way on that is New Hampshire. And they actually adopted a state law that has to do with jury nullification. It seems that this guy named Daryl, he was a Rastafarian piano tuner and woodworker.
Ariman.
And he had been married, the Jolly Man. He had been married for almost four decades, and he was arrested after a National Guard helicopter spotted some marijuana plants on his property. State prosecutors charged him with cultivation, a felony that could carry up to 7 years in prison. It was clear that he had been growing the marijuana. Nobody disputed that. Eventually, Daryl was offered a deal that would allow him to avoid jail time and fines in exchange for a misdemeanor guilty plea. He refused, however, citing his religion, which, as you said, was one of those things, and its view that marijuana is a sacrament. So the case went to trial. The jurors were led by this liberty-minded activist and part of a Free State project and decided that Daryl should be set free. It said, Mr. Daryl is a peaceful man. He never deals with the darker elements of society, and he grows for his own personal religious and medicinal use. I knew that my community would be poorer rather than better off had he been convicted. Now, she's in the jury.
Yeah.
I'm assuming these comments came out afterwards.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So to prevent that, she helped convince other jurors to do as a defense suggested, vote their conscience and declare Daryl a free man. Many of us wondered what kind of precedent this would set. But after chewing on all the possibilities and rereading the definition of nullification, we all decided that the only fair thing to do was vote our conscience and acquit the defendant of all charges. Now, in June of that year before, the nullification advocates secured a major victory as New Hampshire Governor John Lynch signed House Bill 146 into law, allowing defendants to inform jurors about the jury's right to judge the application of the law in relationship to the facts in controversy. The defense attorney acknowledged that the judge's decision to instruct the jury about nullification was crucial to the victory, and that he actually told them, even if you find that the state has proven each and every element of the offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt, you may still find the defendant not guilty if you have a conscientious feeling that a not guilty verdict would be a fair result in this case.
Yeah.
Now, that's rare that a judge would give that kind of guidance.
Well, and yeah, they're not actually allowed to in a lot of places.
New Hampshire, they are.
Yeah. And I was going to get into jury instructions here a little bit later in the podcast, but that's one thing. If there's no instruction on nullification, then juries aren't going to probably do it. They'd be less likely to do it. Now, if you tell them they can, they're going to be more likely to do it.
And that's been a longstanding debate since, you know, in the history of our law is – what is permissible and what isn't when it comes to instructions of jury nullification?
Yeah. And now I have a very strong opinion about that. And I'm going to tell you later. I'm teasing it again. That's a second tease.
That's two teases you're going to owe us.
That's right.
Are they the same tease or is that two different ones?
The same tease.
Oh, same tease. Well, you're really teasing that thing.
I am. I'm going to get to it.
All right. If we forget, it's on you.
Now, there's also, you know, right now we've talked about jury nullification and it's all kind of been warm and fuzzy kind of jury nullification where we're like, oh, well, you know, it's kind of a good thing because that's maybe why it's a good thing.
We're putting it to the man.
That's right. But here's where it was really bad.
Uh-oh.
During the 50s and the 60s, the civil rights movement, sometimes in the South, you saw where basically all white juries refused to convict white defendants of murdering blacks.
Or civil rights workers.
Yeah, or civil rights workers, for that matter. And basically, you can make an argument that that's jury nullification as well. That basically, they decided, hey, you know what? They did it, but I'm not going to follow the law because I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one instance where, you know what? We don't really want juries doing this. So
exactly.
Now, one article I read about in getting ready for this said that in the 50s and 60s in the South, that may not have been as much of a jury nullification type theory, but it was actually more in the fact that the juries were not representative of the people that were there being tried. So you can make an argument there that you know, basically you're entitled to be tried by a jury of your peers, and that basically the people on the jury were not respective of the community in which that was there.
Well, so, and not only that, I don't, you know, we don't know that they actually knew what jury nullification was and that was what they were doing. Or did they just say, I'm not going to vote guilty?
Yeah.
I'm just going to find him innocent.
Yeah. One case that we had talked about before was that of Emmett Till. Remember Emmett?
I don't remember Emmett.
He was lynched in 1955 in Mississippi because he had allegedly whistled at a white woman, and he was a 14-year-old black male, and his killers were acquitted. Mm. And basically in 1955, these guys, Bryant and Millam, the two who were acquitted by an all-white jury, they said publicly that they had kidnapped and murdered him because they were protected against double jeopardy.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for the most part, it was proven in the trial as well that they did it, but the jury said, you know what? We're not following the law.
Well, I mean, certainly there were some times in the past where things like this took place that cannot be condoned and, you know, are really aberrations to what normal society would expect.
Yeah. And so when you talk about jury nullification, I think it is somewhat of a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
There's some good that comes from it, but there's also can be some bad from it, too. So
I just think it shouldn't be such a secret.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing, too. How often does it actually happen is the question. I came across a 1967 Law Review article, which is not exactly cutting news, but and
fresh off the press, 1967.
They had some stats. I'm not sure
how old were you then?
-8. And so I'm not exactly sure how they came up with these stats, but they said juries acquitted when judges would have convicted in only 19% of all cases. And of those 19%, only 21% were attributable to jury nullification. So they're saying that basically it was kind of a fraction of a fraction, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I have no idea how they came up with that, but I mean, they may have been also looking at different things as far as like when the jury convicted somebody of a lesser charge, just different things like that. Or
right.
So I don't know how they came up with it, but it does seem to be that jury nullification is pretty rare. Like you don't see it that often. You have to have almost a perfect storm of things to happen.
Well, early in our history, judges often informed jurors of the nullification right. For example, our first Chief Justice, which was not John Marshall, it was John Jay, told jurors, you have the right to take upon yourself to judge both the facts and law. In 1805, one of the charges against Justice Samuel Chase, now he took an altering view
mm-hmm.
in his impeachment trial, was that he wrongly prevented an attorney from arguing to a jury that the law should not be followed. So amongst the different ones, as they came into power, they've tried to change how this is. And, you know, some of these things are kind of cloaked. Like if they told me I'm on a jury and they say, you have the right to judge both the facts and the law, that's not going to register with me that if I hear everything about him says he's guilty, that I can still say, I don't care, I'm not convicting him.
Yeah.
That's not really going to register with me. Now, if they say, you know, if I understand what jury nullification is, then I'm going to understand, you know, if I don't agree with this, even if they do find him guilty, if I don't agree with this, I can acquit him. So, I mean, I think there's a little bit of vagueness that's put in there, and it's, I don't know if it's written or unwritten, but like as a defense attorney, you can't bring up jury nullification as part of your closing arguments or anything.
No, I mean, if there's you said it was Rhode Island, right? Where they had the
New Hampshire. Where they passed the law, yeah.
If it's in the jury instructions, you can certainly bring it up.
Right.
You can say, hey, you know what? You don't have to follow the law.
Well, and I read a couple other cases where, like, the prosecution will bring something up about it, and they'll say, you may be asked about jury nullification, and you should know that that is not acceptable, that it's not legal, but just that it's not acceptable.
Right.
So once he opened the door, then the defense attorney could explain what jury nullification was to the jury.
Yeah.
So that I've read a few cases where they kind of slipped up doing that.
Now, one other area where there was some jury nullification during a certain era of our country, this is the last one I'm going to bring up, but I just wanted to, it was more recent, was in the 90s, and the juries in certain areas, generally more progressive areas, refused to find gay individuals guilty of violating sodomy laws for consensual sex. So somebody would be charged assuming heterosexual males charged with violating some sort of sodomy law, and basically the jury said, no, you know what? They're grown adults. We're not going to convict them of that.
Yeah, so, they're in their own bedroom, minding their own business. Yeah, we're not going to get into that.
Yeah, so that was one area where there was also some more jury nullification too, which was kind of a good area, a progressive area, I guess, so to speak.
Progressive area.
Yeah, as opposed to like a regressive one. So, and then current days, a lot of jury nullifications probably don't center around any kind of race or progressive issues like homosexual rights or things like that. Right now, mainly when you see these jury nullification things, it has to do with so-called victimless crimes. A lot of times about drug charges where people may be convicted or maybe even charged with some sort of drug crime. And, you know, they're
especially marijuana.
Yeah, marijuana.
Because it's, you know, with everything out and you've got, what's the last statistic? 60% of Americans think it should be legalized, or is it even higher than that?
Yeah. And when you don't have a victim sitting in a chair of somebody who got robbed or something like that, it's just a lot harder case to prove.
So, hey, how about speeding tickets when they catch you on camera? That's a victimless crime, too.
It is.
And you could maybe go to a jury trial and ask them to do jury nullification because you don't agree with the cameras.
Cross-examine that camera.
That's right.
Camera. And how do you... Please state your name for the record. How do you spell Kodak? So as you were saying, we're getting back to jury instructions. A lot of these jury nullification arguments where you're allowed to do it, they focus on the precise language of the jury instruction and the different burden of proof elements. Some jury instructions, as he said, they focus on the issue of the burden of proof, and they almost invite some sort of nullification type arguments. For example, they might say, according to these instructions, juries must find the defendant not guilty if the case has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and conversely, the jury should find the defendant guilty if the case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So on one hand, it's must. On the other hand, it's shall or should. So,
Well, I read another one that actually went to the Supreme Court, and it was about a guy who was convicted, and in the jury instructions, they had told him, basically, they were warning them against jury nullification, and the judge basically, without coming right out and saying it, the way he worded it, it was like, you're breaking the law if you do this.
Yeah.
If you practice jury nullification. And also, he said, there is no such thing as jury nullification.
Right.
Now, so that's what they were saying. Now, wait a minute. You know, he lied to them. First of all, they're not breaking the law. And second of all, there is jury nullification. So his instructions were erroneous. Well, it ended up the Supreme Court didn't agree with him because they said, yes, the first three parts of his instructions were correct. Those two parts were not correct. However, there was a bunch of other laws that were involved in it besides some of these other things. So they just said the guy's still guilty.
That's what we call harmless error.
Yeah. But you saw where this judge stood on jury nullification because he was willing to actually give out bad information at the least and break the law at the worst. For what he was saying was, I mean, if he's, I don't know if they're under, they have to say the truth too. Or I don't know if they're under oath, but what he said were falsehoods.
Yeah.
Was that perjury for a judge?
No, he's not under oath.
So he can say anything he damn well pleases, huh?
To a certain degree.
Here come the judge. Here come the judge.
He might be amiss of some judicial canons, but, you know.
Yeah.
it's really more the duty of the jury to, I think, follow the law and apply it to the case. I don't think it's their idea to, they shouldn't have the ability to say, to decide whether or not a law is fair or not.
Well, I agree with you. They should do that. And here's what I'm going to say. Even these people that advocate jury nullification, you can't just run around and say, we're going to, whatever is proven, we're going to go the other way. I mean, the jury's made up of all these independent people that are coming in there, and there's no reason why they would all go along with this. And it would only be in certain kind of cases. I mean, if you had some kind of heinous crime in front of you or something, why would you acquit the guy?
Yeah.
So you could put him back out in society and kill somebody else or something like that. So the odds of you being an advocate for jury nullification and then getting put on a jury where you could actually practice that, I would think those odds are pretty small. And then what's going to be the odds you get 12 of you that are on there that'll go along with that?
There was a case in 1969, the Fourth Circuit, U.S. v. Moylan, and there's a quote from there. It's a little bit longer, but I'm going to read it because I think it's kind of interesting. It says, "We recognize, as appellants urge, the undisputed power of the jury to acquit, even if its verdict is contrary to the law as given by the judge and contrary to the evidence. This is a power that must exist as long as we adhere to the general verdict in criminal cases, for the courts cannot search the minds of the jurors to find the basis upon which they judge. If the jury feels that the law under which the defendant is accused is unjust, or that exigent circumstances justified the actions of the accused, or for any reason which appeals to their logic or passion, the jury has the power to acquit, and the courts must abide by that decision." And then they basically went on to say, "By clearly stating to the jury that they may disregard the law, telling them that they may decide according to their own prejudice or consciences, for there is no check to ensure that the judgment is based upon conscience rather than prejudice, we would indeed be negating the rule of law in favor of the rule of lawlessness. This should not be allowed." That, I think, surmises jury nullification in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand that it is part of it, and if a jury comes to that conclusion, yes, we're going to live with it, but at the same time, we don't want to encourage it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that basically legislature and it's their job to figure out these laws, not 12 people in a jury room. That was my tease. That's the final result right there.
That was your tease?
Well, that wasn't my tease. That was my payoff. That was the payoff, as we say in podcasting lingo.
Well, here was another one that kind of goes along those same lines. Now, it's kind of one of those ones where they're talking about evening things up. It's easy to defend nullification when a law or its application is unjust, and it is likewise easy to condemn nullification when it reflects misogyny or racism or a personal reaction to the parties to the case. But are there in-between situations? Paul Butler, a law professor at Georgetown University, has argued that nullification should be used by African-American jurors when an African-American defendant stands accused of a nonviolent crime as a way of reducing the racial disparity in convictions for such offenses. Now, such a practice, if it became widespread, would discredit African-American potential jurors being considered for a case and would do little to truly address the problem of the disparate treatment.
Yeah.
Because the law and prosecutorial. Discretion would continue to operate the same way as it did before in most cases.
Yeah, you want the laws to be changed.
Yeah, and so you don't want to be signed up for something like that because that's going to come back and bite you. You're going to not be able to serve on juries, and then you're going to be one less voice, maybe of reason.
Now, there was one judge who actually advocated for a jury nullification instruction, and this was the Chief Justice of the Washington State Supreme Court, William C. Goodloe. He basically was of the opinion, he said, "You are instructed that this being a criminal case, you are the exclusive judges of the evidence, the credibility of the witnesses, and the weight to which to give their testimony, and you have a right to also determine the law in the case. The court does not intend to express any opinion concerning the weight of evidence, but it is the duty of the court to advise you as to the law, and it is your duty to consider the instructions of the court. Yet in your decision upon the merits of the case, you have a right to determine for yourselves the law as well as the facts by which the verdict shall be governed."
Hmm.
So basically he's putting it all in their hands.
Yeah, and there's some that argue that that's putting too much responsibility on the juries.
Now there's one political party that is for jury nullification. Do you know who it is?
The Libertarians.
Exactly. They're all for it.
Well, of their name, it gave it away.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, there was one other famous case, supposedly, and it involves somebody that you've probably heard of.
Who's that?
Bill Cosby.
I've heard of Bill Cosby.
But it's not the Bill Cosby you're thinking of, but you've probably heard of this one before, too. You remember we had a story about the governor of New York that
yes.
was named Bill Cosby?
I do remember that.
It's that Bill Cosby from 1735.
The original.
The most famous.
The OG Bill Cosby.
That's right. The OG. The most famous nullification case is the 1735 trial of John Peter Zinger, charged with printing seditious libels of the governor of the colony of New York, Bill Cosby. Despite the fact that Zinger clearly printed the alleged libels, the only issue the court said the jury was free to decide, as the court deemed the truth or falsity of the statements irrelevant, the jury could only decide whether he actually printed them or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody knew he printed them, but the jury nonetheless returned a verdict of not guilty. He instructed them, doesn't matter if it was true or not. If he put them up, he's guilty. And they said not guilty, even though he put them up. And what I also wondered out of that is, I wonder if that's where a zinger comes from. You know, you gave a zinger, because you think about it. He went around and put these up, these things up over where he was zinging him.
It very well could be.
And I wonder if that's where a zinger came from. I always heard that as a saying. Boy, he really zinged him. I wonder if that's where that came from. It's a zinger. I think we just discovered something from history.
You might be onto something there.
Yeah, you never know. You know, even a blind hog will find an acorn now and then.
Acorn?
Yeah.
So, as you can guess, I would generally not argue for any kind of jury nullification during a case, or even really want it to happen, because I feel like the law is the law, and I really want a jury to follow it. Now, I could see arguing for it in some of these circumstances where it's just a really, really bad law, but I think that is actually the final straw. I would not ask a jury to not follow the law unless it was something that was just completely horrible. I mean, that would basically be the same as me, like, that's the, you know, dropping the A-bomb. I wouldn't do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not going to do it, because I don't want to have jury nullification. I want the jury to follow the law, because I think the law, if it's going to be changed, it should be changed on the legislative level, not by a jury.
Right. And they say sometimes juries will stumble into that just based on their like or dislike of the person on trial. Less offensive, but also problematic, are juries' feelings about the defendant. In one case, a grand jury refused to indict a man, and the man's because of the man's disarming and sweet personality. At one point, when the accused was about to testify, a grand juror sitting at the front of the room encouraged him to fix his shirt, as though he were her son, rather than accused criminals whose conduct she was assessing. And if jurors either like the defendant very much or dislike the victim in a particular case, they could choose to bring back an acquittal, notwithstanding the incontrovertible evidence of guilt. That is part of why defense attorneys often try to portray a victim in very negative and unappealing ways, so the jurors might conclude that he or she needed killing.
Yeah.
Or at least does not deserve to have the perpetrator punished.
I had a criminal case. This has probably been 10 years ago. And a juror came up to me after a guilty verdict against my client. And they said, you know, you did a really good job, and I really wanted to vote not guilty for you, but I couldn't do it. I just didn't like your client. I was like, thank you.
I guess. Well, that's good. I mean, if you'd gotten 12 people that liked you.
Yeah, well,
it might have worked, you know?
It didn't like me enough to get my client off.
Well, he was a heinous dude.
He was a heinous dude. He drove that jet ski drunk. Which he did.
Sorry to hear about that. I told you about the case there in 1670, mm-hmm. where the Quakers had the tumultuous meeting and that jury went. One of the other things that came up, the only other time where a jury or a juror was held responsible, came about in 1994. Now, back when the Bill of Rights was ratified, 1791, in it says, or part of it were defined juries. Juries are finable if they are unlawfully dealt with to give their verdict, but they are not finable for giving their verdict contrary to the evidence or against the direction of the court. For the law supposes the jury may have some other evidence than what is given the court, and they may not only find things of their own knowledge, but they go according to their consciences. Now, besides that Quaker one, there was one, a case of Laura Creho in Colorado in 1994. And she was on the jury deciding the fate of a defendant charged with drug possession. And Creho refused to vote guilty. Now, what she had at issue was the extremely long sentence that was going to, the guy had some methamphetamines.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't say exactly how long it was, but that she felt it was an unnecessarily long sentence that was right. associated with it. So it wasn't because she didn't think that he was guilty of possessing drugs, but she didn't think it was fair, the sentence that he was going to get should he be convicted. So she started explaining to the rest of the jury about jury nullification and that she thought they should all do that.
Yeah.
So one of the other jurors slipped a note to the judge and told him about that. Well, she was pulled out and she was charged with contempt of court and fined $1,200.
Wow.
And So then they said what when they dug into it, what they found out was she had been arrested and charged with a felony drug possession in the past. So they tried to say, well, you lied when we
asked you questions. You perjured yourself.
We asked you, had you been involved in this? You said no. Well, what they asked her is, had she ever been convicted? What happened is the case got dropped before it ever went to trial.
Yeah.
So when she said, no, I have never been convicted, she was telling the truth.
Right.
But they said, well, there were some other questions. You knew what we were getting at. You weren't exactly honest. You knew that if that had come up, you should have told us about it.
Yeah.
So they tried to use that as she got on the jury under false circumstances. Yeah. So it eventually went to a higher court, and the higher court overturned it and said, just because she started talking about jury nullification, she answered your questions.
Yeah, I would love to be the defense attorney arguing that. I'd look at the jury and say, this could be you. This judge could put you in this defendant's seat.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to set this precedent.
So they were saying that, you know, that she got out of it. Now, most people wouldn't want to go through all that, but they said,
heck no.
Here's their advice. If you are going to go into a jury situation and you think you might be tempted to use jury nullification, first, step one, be a quitter. After you receive your jury summons, you should immediately cancel memberships with organizations that might get you struck from the jury. These include all, but are not limited to, FIJA, Normal, DPA, the Libertarian Party, MPP, and the ACLU. It said, tell the truth and shut up. Take the questions literally and answer as briefly and generally as you truthfully can. If they said, how do you feel about people accused of breaking the law in question? You would say, they deserve fair trials, just like anyone else convicted of a crime or accused of a crime. So do that. Do not mention nullification in the jury room. So even though you might be leaning that way, you don't want to just come right out and say, hey, y'all, let's practice jury nullification. I can fill you in about it.
Yeah. And again, I don't think it's proper.
Hmm.
That's just my two cents on it.
Well, I say that it has its place. I mean, I think some of the marijuana laws right now, there's times where I think in society that the rest of the government hasn't caught up with it. I think there's some things like that.
I agree, but I think we need our legislature to change those things. I don't think it's up to a jury to do that.
Well, they should, but they're a little slow. Sometimes you have to urge them along.
Now, if it was a marijuana case and they were actually prosecuting somebody for it, I'm sure I would constantly be saying just weed, only weed, thing, you know, those kinds of words when I'm talking about it, because that's what I would be basically priming the jury for. I'd want to put that in their mind that it was, you know, hey, it's just a little weed. What's the big deal?
Well, now here's a few that, let me ask you how you feel about them, because they're supposed to be famous nullification ones. We already talked about OJ, George Zimmerman.
Yeah.
I say that was a case of jury nullification.
Yeah, not good.
All right. What about Lorena Bobbitt? You remember that case? Well, Lorena had been getting abused by her husband, John, and he went into these drunken rages and took it out on her and raped her against her will and things like that. And
yeah, but she took the law and other things into her own hands.
Yeah, she took a knife and cut his penis off and actually drove off with it. Now, I'm wondering how that took place. She's driving down the road, the steering wheel in one hand and his penis in the other. And I wonder at what point she either looked up and said, oh, I didn't realize I still had that. Or did she say, this looks like a good spot to throw this out. I think I'll throw it here. So she threw it out by the side of the road. Now, who was the person that went out and found it? I don't know. I mean, I'm picturing one of those side of the road guys with the nail on the end of the stick going around picking up trash. Look at this. Where did this come from? I don't know. But all I know is,
he's like, that's a penis.
I found a penis over here. But anyway, they ended up reattaching it. He became a member again. And he actually made a porn movie called John Bobbitt Uncut.
Detachable penis.
Yeah. But she went to trial, and there was no doubt she had done it, that she had, you know, mutilated him. But she got acquitted of it because they also spoke about the abuse and everything else that went on. And, you know, they ended up acquitting her, and that was a case of jury nullification.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like it. Now, the thing is that in a case like that, I doubt that she actually took the stand. They probably let the prosecution put their case on, and then they might have put on some other people who talked about the abuse that went on, things like that. But, you know, that might have been it, if I had to guess, with that case.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't follow the case other than that was really something to read about. You remember Roger Clemens, famous Major League Baseball player, is one of the best pitchers there ever was. And he was brought into a performance-enhancing drug case.
Mm-hmm.
And he has supposedly been to some, attended a party with Jose Canseco that involved human growth hormone and all this kind of stuff. And he said he didn't know anything about it. Well, this was in the early days of it, of the drug enhancement stuff. And a bunch of baseball players suddenly got all muscled up and everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he perjured himself.
Yeah.
Well, he perjured himself, so they brought him in, and they had a hung jury the first time, so then they were going to recharge him again, and the people basically on the jury were like, he wasn't playing baseball anymore. All kinds of other people had done it, too. He just happened to be high profile and get brought in, and they were like, what's the use? What are we gaining out of this? And they acquitted him of it just to get it over with, you know?
Yeah.
Wild Bill Hickok. You know who Wild Bill Hickok is?
The old Wild West guy.
Yeah, he was an old Wild West guy. Not to be confused with Buffalo Bill. This was a different Bill.
Okay.
This was Wild Bill, not Buffalo Bill. Well, he was accused of the murder of a cowboy, Davis Tutt, in the second degree. The two had a disagreement, which resulted in a gunfight in the town square of Springfield, Missouri, during which Wild Bill shot and killed Tutt. Hickok would have been found guilty if the outcome of the case was driven on facts alone, but was acquitted of his crimes thanks to jury nullification and the unwritten law of a fair fight. So that was okay they did it.
It was a fair fight. He drew first.
That's right. Dr. Jack Kevorkian?
Yeah.
He admitted that he euthanized those people, and juries never convicted him.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, there's Ed Fortune. Which you may not recognize that name.
I recognize the last name.
Do you?
Yeah. I don't know why.
Well, he's also known as, he's also known as the New Jersey Weed Man. Mm. Does that ring a bell? You don't know the New Jersey Weed Man?
I do not know of any New Jersey Weed Man, Tommy.
He's an advocate for the legalization of marijuana and jury nullification. He has been arrested numerous times for his use of marijuana. Now, but here's the hitch. Forshawn suffers from a form of bone cancer, and instead of taking pain medication, he uses medical marijuana. A native to New Jersey, where medical marijuana is not legal, Fortune was arrested for possession of an intent to distribute marijuana. Acting as his own attorney, Forshawn presented his case so the jurors understood and sympathized with his side of the story. He also informed them of their right to acquit him of charges based on the principle of jury nullification, which the jury did. He was able to tell them that, you know, give them a convincing story why he needed to be able to have the marijuana, and also tell them about jury nullification, and that's how he got off. But, you know, there's a lot of studies that are out now that say that using marijuana is better than opioids.
Yeah, like that made me think of the line from Blow with Johnny Depp. He's like, I took a plant across some imaginary lines, as he told the judge.
Yeah.
I said, unfortunately, sir, that plant was against the law. Those lines were real.
But the thing is that that's what I think our jury nullification horizon is right now, is the changing marijuana laws and where those are at. And with our opioid problem that we have, if we could get rid of those and marijuana could replace it, it certainly seems like a much better alternative because it doesn't have the addictive effects.
I'm all for that, and I don't have a problem with that. And the jury nullification leaves not a bad taste in my mouth with regard to the marijuana, but as in general, as a rule, I don't really care much for it.
Well, if it was skunk weed, it would leave a bad taste in your mouth.
It would be all cotton mouth. So that's going to bring us to Legal Briefs is a part of the show where I ask Tommy different terms and see if he remembers what they are. So to start it off with, what does cotton mouth mean?
Cotton mouth? It means you've smoked too much dope and your mouth's all dried out.
Exactly. How do you know that?
Well, I heard Mary talk about it. She went to Barbersville. We only drank at East.
That's right. I mean, Tommy and I both graduated from the same high school.
It was that country school that they did their own. The Future Farmers was the biggest group out there, the biggest club, so... You know, that's what the future farmers were growing. They knew what the future was.
We went to the city high school. one of the city high schools.
Right.
What is jury nullification?
Jury nullification is when the jury, despite the preponderance of evidence to convict somebody, comes back and says not guilty because they either don't agree with the law or they're voting their conscience or don't believe it was applied properly.
That's right. What amendment is the Double Jeopardy Clause located in?
I'm going to say the... Oh, darn. We talked about so many darn amendments. Usually we only talk about certain ones. The Eighth Amendment.
No.
The Sixth Amendment.
No.
The Fifth Amendment.
Yes! Third time's a charm. It's the Fifth Amendment. It contains that, and it also contains the right to not incriminate
yourself.
That's right. What was the 18th Amendment?
That was the one that prohibited alcohol.
That's right. And what was what's our favorite amendment?
The 21st Amendment.
That's right. That's the one that said, hey, you know what? Alcohol's okay.
Well, I do want alcohol, and it is okay.
That's right.
All right, I got one for you.
I'm always scared when that happens.
What was the first name of the guy who ever did the first zinger?
Oh, you mean Mr. Zinger?
His first name's not Mr.
Ernest.
Wrong.
John J. Ernest Zinger. I don't know.
Peter.
Peter Zinger?
Peter Zinger. So if somebody ever comes up and does something like that, then you've just been Peter Zingered.
Don't get that mixed up with Lorena Bobbitt, because she was a Peter Slinger. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf, and I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.